Hello and welcome to another On the Hoof podcast episode for Vets in Practice. I'm Alison Braddock, Marketing and Business Development Manager for SRUC Veterinary Services, and I'm your host today. The purpose of this podcast is to communicate details of various projects centred around calf health and colostrum that have been ongoing in recent times. And there's been a lot of projects. These include failure to transfer passive immunity, FTPI, and colostrum quality in Scottish dairy calves, comparison of testing strategies for FTPI, critical control points for colostrum cleanliness, low colostrum yield, Mycoplasma bovis, M. bovis prevalence in first milking colostrum, colostrum preservation, extended colostrum feeding. Wow, that is quite a list. I am delighted to welcome two special guests who we've had on the podcast previously, Ali Haggerty and Katie Denholm. Hello.
Hello, Alison.
Hi, Alison.
And welcome to the podcast. And thank you for joining us. So it would be helpful for our listeners if you could actually introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about your background. So, Katie.
So thanks for having me on again. I work at the University of Glasgow as a farm animal clinician, and I have a special research interest in calf health and young stock management, with a particular focus on colostrum management in dairy calves. I've done quite a lot of work in this subject, both in New Zealand and now in Scotland. And we're really excited to communicate some of our more recent work. Ali's been pivotal to some of these projects gaining traction. And so we're really excited to try and extension message some of our research findings, because that's really, you know, important to us, that you guys, you know, it's not just blue sky research, it's actually applied science.
That's great, Katie. And Ali.
Hi Alison. I'm Ali Haggerty. I am based down in the southwest of Scotland, where I balance my time between clinical practice, so still very much at the call face, but I also do a bit of freelance consultancy, and that involves a variety of things, work with some of the milk processors, other industry bodies, and a portion of my time is devoted to the double act that Katie and I have become with all things kind of calf health and colostrum, and really putting kind of Scotland on the map a little bit with finding out with what the picture is with FTPI and colostrum and dairy calves in Scotland.
That's great, Ali. So before we discuss the projects you have on the go, Katie, although well known to our listeners, can you give us a quick overview of the importance of that first feed of colostrum?
So this is something that's discussed a lot in the literature. And basically what happens is the calf really needs to ingest colostrum from its dam within the first hours of life in order to confer immunity across the calf's gut into its bloodstream. And if that fails to happen, then calves are less likely to thrive. So they're more likely to get sick, usually from respiratory disease and diarrhea, and they're more likely to die. And then crucially, and actually quite amazingly to me anyway, what happens to calves in the first 24 hours of their lives impacts them more long term. So they don't grow as well as their other calves that have had adequate transfer of immunity, and they don't conceive as well, and they don't actually produce as much milk when they hit the herd as first lactation heifers. So there's a lot of economic reason, as well as calf health and welfare reason, to get colostrum management right. It's hugely impactful.
So, Katie, everyone knows about the three Qs of colostrum management. Can you just give us a recap?
Yeah, at the risk of sounding like a broken record, I think it's important that we just get everyone on the same page when we're talking about colostrum management. So the three Qs that you'll be familiar with communicating colostrum management strategies with your farmers are that calves need to receive colostrum quickly, ideally within the first 6 hours of life. They need to receive an adequate quantity of colostrum, traditionally 10 to 12% of their body weight, but the more recent literature would suggest that they need 200 to up to 300 grams in mass of IgG supplied. And in order to do that, they need to ingest colostrum of adequate quality. So over 50 grams per liter of IgG in the colostrum, and also low bacterial colony forming units per mil. So less than 100,000 colony forming units per mil total bacto count, and less than 10,000 colony forming units per mil of total coliform count. And the other two cues, which I am going to throw in the mix here, are that the calves need to receive the colostrum in a stress-free, quiet environment, because stressed calves don't absorb IgG molecules, and that as vets, we need to quantify how well our colostrum management program is actually going. So what that looks like is measuring IgG concentration in the calf serum and measuring IgG concentration in colostrum. And the magic numbers are over 50 grams per liter of IgG in colostrum, and the old threshold of 10 grams per liter IgG in serum, which basically is an indicator of how likely your calf is to die. So more recent research would suggest that actually we should be aiming for more like 15 grams per liter IgG in serum in order for calves to thrive.
Thank you, Katie. So Ali, can you tell us about the 2019 project looking at the failure to transfer passive immunity and colostrum quality in Scottish dairy calves?
Yeah, this actually formed part of my master's, and I guess we should start just by making sure we're all on the same page. We've banded about this term FTPI, that used to be FPT. So what we're talking about, it's the failure to transfer passive immunity, and the previous acronym was FPT, failure of passive transfer. Well, actually, technically, this process isn't passive, it's active. The antibodies are actively taken up from the calf's gut into the systemic circulation. So it's just a little tweak of the acronym, and it's probably quite a good thing to highlight just before we delve into the topic any deeper. It's FTPI now that we talk about. So back in 2019, what we did, we wanted to answer the questions: what is the prevalence of FTPI in the dairy calf population? We wanted to talk about the diagnostic test performance. We wanted to investigate that, leaning into the old adage that if we want to monitor a situation, we need to be able to measure it and manage it. So we wanted to know about the diagnostic test performance that we used, and we also wanted to pull out risk factors associated with FTPI and colostrum quality. So as I said, we enrolled 38 farms across Scotland, so across the milk field in Scotland. We sampled 392 dairy calves aged from 24 hours to 7 days old. We convinced farm staff to collect 252 colostrum samples for us, and that was at the point of feeding. So that was actually what was going into the dairy calves. And from that, we collated a lot of results looking at how much antibody was in the serum of the calves, and also we looked at colostrum quality in terms of cleanliness and IgG concentration. So what did we find? Well, we found that 1 in 7 calves suffered from FTPI. In this study, we used the traditional cut point of 10 grams per liter. This cut point is centered around preventing mortality only, in a space where we're now discussing marginal gains, and we're discussing efficiencies and linking it all up to various bits and pieces like carbon footprinting. We really want to not just prevent calves from dying on farm, we want them to thrive, we want them to grow well. So really we're looking to sort of maximise the amount of IgG in these calves' bloodstream at sort of 24 hours of age. We also looked at the colostrum quality measure and the headline result there, that when we took into account BRICS, and in this study we used the 22% BRICS cut point, and we used the total bacterial count cut points of 100,000 colony forming units per mil and the coliform count of 10,000 coliforming units per mil. So when we took all those together, overall, about 40% of the colostrum samples failed in some terms of quality. So that really gave a picture that there's some low-hanging fruit, that we can make some good strides and steps to mitigate some of the things that Katie discussed that impact calves with FTPI. As I said, the headline result was 1 in 7 calves failed in terms of FTPI. When we delved down onto individual farm level, there was huge variation. There were some farms that were consistently achieving very good results, with 100% of calves having adequate transfer of passive immunity, but there were some farms that were consistently failing with a large portion of calves. So there is individual farm variation. We looked at some of these results in context with other work in the UK, and it is, the picture is quite repeatable. There was work down in the south of England, and they had the FTPI prevalence of around kind of 20%, so a wee bit worse at 1 in 5 calves. But the dirtiness of the colostrum samples was coming out in other studies that similar sort of around that kind of 35-37% mark. As I mentioned, one of the other things we did is we looked at various risk factors that was involved in reduced colostrum quality, and the two big headlines that we pulled out there was the increased time from parturition and colostrum harvest. So the longer you leave between the cow calving and her being milked, well, that's associated with a lower BRICS percentage of the colostrum. And that's really centred around the fact that at around calving, the transfer of IgG into the udder stops and then it declines. So if we leave more time between calving and harvesting the colostrum, we are naturally harvesting less quality in terms of IgG. Also, we found another risk factor, that the increased time that a colostrum sample spent in the bucket prior to feeding was associated with high bacterial counts. So really what we want to do is we want to harvest this quickly. We want to then feed or store it quickly. We don't want it sitting around in buckets where there's opportunities for contamination.
Thank you, Ali. So it sounds like there are gains to be made here. Katie, can you talk about testing calves for FTPI and the work you've done around that?
Yeah, thanks, Alison. So basically, we're advocating for farmers and vets to monitor the situation on individual farms. And what that looks like in practice is measuring colostrum quality using either a colostrometer, which is a little bit of an outdated device these days because these things are quite fragile and quite temperature dependent. They indirectly estimate the IgG concentration in colostrum. And what works a bit better if you're trying to use a pen side test is a BRICS refractometer to test colostrum quality. So the way the BRICS refractometer works is it estimates the total solids in colostrum, and it refracts the light around the total solids in the liquid colostrum and gives you an estimate for how much IgG is in the sample. So we advocate using one of those. It's a really amazing device in that it's dual purpose. You can use the same Brix refractometer to measure the calf serum IgG or estimate the calf serum IgG concentration. And the magic number for colostrum is 22% on the Brix, and the magic number for serum is about 8.5%. So these are really useful pen side tests, but they aren't directly measuring IgG concentration in the blood or the colostrum. They are estimating it. So the gold standard traditional reference test is called radial immunodiffusion. And this is the one that we used in our work as our sort of reference or gold standard test to work out whether the Brix refractometer was any good at estimating serum IgG concentrations in Scottish dairy calves. And because many clinicians are using other testing strategies, such as total protein, ZST testing, or even GGT testing, which stands for gamma glutamyl transferase, we actually did a comparison of the ones that are in most popular use. So we looked at how well the indirect measures of Brix refractometry, total protein, and ZST testing worked in comparison to the gold standard radial immunodiffusion test. And what we found was that the agreement was actually pretty good for the Brix and the total protein tests for estimating serum IgG concentration. The total protein test was probably the more superior of them in terms of agreement with the reference test, but all of the indirect measures actually underestimated the IgG concentration in calf serum, which resulted in an overestimation of FTPI prevalence, which is fine if you're using these tests as a monitoring tool, because we're less interested in the individual calf being classified correctly, but more interested in trends. So if you're using indirect measures of FTPI in calves as a monitoring tool, and you're repeat sampling every 4 weeks or so to get a picture of the prevalence of FTPI, they are still very useful tests, even though they aren't as good as directly measuring IgG concentration. And the reason people don't directly measure IgG concentration is because the radial immunodiffusion test is really costly. But some of you will be aware that there's a new ELISA lateral flow test on the market, which directly measures IgG concentration. And that could be a really useful thing to look at in future, although we haven't actually tested that up to now in our labs. So what we found when we measured the performance of the test that we did look at was that if you lower the cut points for total protein testing, lower the cut points for Brix refractometry, and crucially lower the cut points for ZST testing, you actually get better agreement with the gold standard radial immunodiffusion test. So we're advocating 15 units for ZST, 5 grams per deciliter for total protein, and about just over 8% for Brix for our Scottish dairy calves. And that means you're going to get the best agreement with the gold standard test. And then because a lot of vets in Scotland are using total protein testing, the question was then, should we be sending the total protein off to the laboratory, which costs £7 every time you do that, or can we use the refractometer pen side? And the answer is that the wet chemistry test in the lab is more accurate, but the refractometer is still very useful because you can use it right then and there and get a reading next to your calf. And important just to reiterate that the analysis of serum samples should be interpreted with care. Many clinicians present us with scenarios where they've collected small numbers of serum samples from calves. We really need to collect at least a dozen samples from calves between 24 hours old and 7 days old. And we need to consider the disease or the possible disease prevalence in the population of interest, which from Ali's master's work was about 14-15% of calves with FTPI. And the test performance will be affected by how much failure of passive transfer there is actually in that group of calves. So important to test periodically in using the test in series, so testing monthly and testing adequate numbers of calves, because we're using these tools as herd monitoring tools rather than individual calf tools.
Thank you, Katie. So, Ali, can you tell us about your most recent project looking at colostrum cleanliness?
Yes, Alison, this is a project that's just drawing to a close. We spent a period of time last year collecting more colostrum samples from farms in Dumfries and Galloway, and we were really looking at the critical control points for colostrum contamination. So we wanted to answer the question, on farm, where is this colostrum getting dirty? So we took samples from the teat, the buckets, and the feeders. So we took samples across the sort of the journey of colostrum as it progresses from harvest to the farm. And why are we worried about this? Well, bacteria do several things to reduce passive transfer of immunity. They can physically bind to the antibody or the IgG in the gut, meaning that it can't transfer across. They damage the brush border, which increases the speed in which the neonatal enterocytes sort of close to antibodies, and they also physically block the gaps, and they can cleave the antibody molecule, this sort of Y-shaped molecule. They can damage it, and it's particularly the coliforms that do this. So we wanted to answer the question, where is it getting dirty and how can we stop it? So we've been looking at the results, we've been having a sort of delve into them, and some of the results are quite staggering. The amount of contamination. So we've got a headline result that the maximum bacterial count that we had for a feeder sample, so we've taken a sample out of the colostrum that a calf was getting fed, and it was 295 million bacteria per mil. So that was in such a small volume, and if considering on average calves will get fed 3 or 4 litres. So if we multiply that up, that's just a horrible soup of bugs that we're putting straight into the calves' gut. I've given you the headline of the maximum. Of course, there was a range of results, and some colostrum was coming back completely clean. There was no growth. So it is possible to harvest and process a clean colostrum sample, but some of the headlines were very, very, very dirty. And we did a wee bit of statistical analysis, and basically as the colostrum sample progresses from harvest through from each bucket to the feeder, there's a difference in total bacterial, total coliform counts. They're getting dirtier. So that was the kind of the first arm, and we're still pulling out bits and pieces of result from there. The second arm of that study is that we looked at the prevalence of Mycoplasma bovis in first milking colostrum samples. People listening to this podcast will be well versed in what a challenge Mycoplasma bovis is in terms of calf health and calf rearing, and they'll be well versed in the pneumonias and otitises and arthritis and chronic infections that are associated with it. But the control strategies, there's multiple different control strategies, and one of the control strategies focuses around colostrum, because it can be transferred in colostrum. So we wanted to answer the question, what is the prevalence, how much mycoplasma is in first milk and colostrum. So we did a power calculation to check how many samples we needed to take, and we submitted 79 samples into the SRUC to check for mycoplasma DNA. And the result came back that only one sample, which was tested in duplicate, came back inconclusive for mycoplasma DNA. So after a bit of discussion with the lab and what this meant, ultimately there's likely to be low levels of DNA of mycoplasma DNA in that sample. So I've been quite careful with my wording when I'm talking to you about this mycoplasma DNA. What we haven't done is we haven't looked at or proven the infectious risk of that DNA being there. All we find out that the prevalence of mycoplasma bovis in first milking colostrum is sitting around 1.3%. So it's very, very low. What does that mean if we put our sort of practical clinician hats back on? I guess it kind of means that not to just hang your hat on one piece of advice when controlling this disease. You need to be focusing on how it spreads through fomites. So that's things that can carry it, like around water troughs, around feeders, but also the aerosol spread from calf to calf. And the 1.3% prevalence, that's kind of in line with work that was done in Belgium that came out as a prevalence in colostrum at 1.9%. So, you know, we're in the kind of same ballpark. So it's likely that it is a lower prevalence. But I guess it's probably to bear in mind and talk about these results in context of the farms that we sampled. These farms had, 9 out of the 11 farms had reported some sort of historic disease. So they'd identified it either through bulk milk or post-mortem examinations or bloods or nasal swabs. So they knew that they had it on. So it could be that the picture might be slightly different on a farm that has active, for example, mycoplasmocytosis. They might see more shedding, or farms that haven't actively controlled it in the past. So there might be a little bit of farm-to-farm variation and just care when you're sort of extrapolating these results. But the sort of ultimate headline is that as clinicians, we probably need to focus on the aerosol and fomite spread as well and in line with colostrum, but not hanging our hat on that pasteurising colostrum will be our panacea and our silver bullet to curing this disease. So that was quite an interesting piece that came out.
Thank you, Ali. That's really interesting. So colostrum is obviously a vital resource on the farm. Katie, you've recently published a review on preserving colostrum. Can you discuss some key points from this?
Yeah, sure. Mostly on Scottish dairy farms, we use low temperature preservation to try to keep the bacterial contamination low and the IgG concentration high. Mm-hmm. There has been some literature published to show that if you leave colostrum sitting for long periods at ambient temperature, the bacterial colonies will double every 30 minutes. And sometimes the bacteria can actually cleave the Y-shaped IgG molecule so that it becomes redundant. So not only do the bacterial species multiply, but also the IgG concentration declines when the colostrum is sitting at ambient temperatures in a bucket. So most dairy farmers will use refrigeration or freezers to preserve their colostrum, first milking colostrum. And the trouble is that mostly they don't know what temperature their fridges and freezers are at. So the rule of thumb is the refrigeration temperature for first milking colostrum is 4°C. And you can store first milking colostrum at 4°C for about 2 to 3 days before you feed it. If you're going to freeze it, the temperature needs to be -20°C. And you can keep first milking colostrum in the freezer for about 6 months before you feed it. It's important to note the cow number that the colostrum was harvested from and the date of harvest on the containers. And usually we recommend that the containers that the colostrum is frozen in on or more than 2 liters in volume, because the colostrum needs to be defrosted in a hot water bath. And if there's large quantities of it, the hot water or the heat has trouble penetrating the middle of the high volume container. You can't microwave colostrum to defrost it, incidentally, because you'll make hot pockets. And IgG molecules are denatured at 60 degrees C or higher. So we usually recommend that a hot water bath is used if low temperature preservation is in action on the farm. Other things that people can do are, you can use chemical preservation techniques. So you can use things like citric acid, formic acid. In the bad old days, people used to use formaldehyde, hydrogen peroxide, carcinogenic and quite reactive substances. So we don't usually advocate those because they're dangerous. And actually citric acid and formic acid, the literature would suggest that they're questionably good at preserving colostrum. But the one that's in popular use, particularly in Antipodean systems where there is a large volume of colostrum produced in seasonal calving systems, is potassium sorbate. And the beauty of potassium sorbate is that it's licensed for food production because it's used for cheese and wine production for human consumption. So what you do is you order your potassium sorbate granules and you mix up the potassium sorbate into a 50% solution and you spike your colostrum at 1% by volume. So that's really good at keeping the bacterial counts low, even at ambient temperatures, actually. But, you know, some people are using it together with refrigeration. And then in other parts of the world where freezers and fridges are in short supply, people are making what's known as colostrum silage, which is anaerobic fermentation, a bit like you would make ordinary silage. And that's useful enough to try and keep bacterial colonies low. But sometimes the nutritive value of the colostrum is lost if you're creating colostrum silage. So, and that's not something that we would usually consider in our northern hemisphere systems, but just important to sort of note it. It's an interesting tangent. We also incidentally tested lactobacillus cultures, and we found that if you add yogurt lactobacillus cultures to colostrum, it's as good as doing nothing. So they don't work. So we usually either recommend low temperature preservation or potassium sorbate chemical preservation for first milking colostrum.
That's fascinating. So do we have instances where cows just don't produce enough colostrum, Katie?
Yeah, this was a sort of clinician-led paper that we published recently because we were hearing that farmers were struggling with not only colostrum quality, but also that sometimes the cows were just not producing enough first milking colostrum to cater for the number of neonatal calves. And so we did a small scale study on one of our commercial dairy farms. And we measured risk factors for low colostrum volume. And we did find a temperature and UV light effect. So the larger the temperature differential between like the lowest temperature and the highest temperature on any given day, if there was a big differential between the minimum and maximum daily temperature, then the cows didn't produce very much colostrum. And if the UV index was lower, the cows didn't produce as much colostrum. And this is really important also if the cows were not dry for long enough. So the magic number from that work was 60 days. So anything that was dry for less than 60 days just didn't produce a very nice volume of colostrum. So this is kind of in line with other work which showed seasonal effects on colostrum yields. And also age effects, which we saw in our work too. So the older cows were more likely to produce more volume of first milking colostrum. So it's sort of an emerging area in the literature. There's been some work done from North America on this as well, and it is a problem. So yeah, I guess the things that farmers can control are dry period length and pre-calving nutrition, although the effect of specific dietary formulations is still a bit unknown on colostrum volume or colostrum yield. And it depends whether you're dealing with primiparous or multiparous cows. The optimal crude protein percentage and starch percentage will depend on lactation number as well. So yeah, an interesting area, and we have done a small amount of work in that space.
I guess it's one of the frustrating things about this area is, as Katie said, it is a relatively common complaint that throughout the season farmers will say, oh, the colostrum yield is dropping off. But unfortunately, the work that's in this space isn't producing a nice quick fix or a nice quick answer. So as well as Katie has said, there are some things that you can control in the long term, like dry period length and things like that. A lot of the advice at the moment centres around storing colostrum in times of excess. So when you do have spare colostrum, get it stored in a freezer in a sort of hygienic fashion and noting the quality, and also relying on colostrum replacers, really. So it's storing in excess and relying on replacers at the moment is the advice around low colostrum yield. But hopefully in a few years' time, we might be sat here, Alison, and having a different conversation with some solutions.
Yes, indeed. So would either of you like to discuss extended colostrum feeding?
Yeah, we've got some ongoing work in that space as well. I don't have any results at the moment to share with you, but essentially there's a growing body of literature to suggest that while the first feed of colostrum is absolutely crucial in terms of the calf's productive life and its health and well-being, a lot of farmers have traditionally switched calves immediately on to either whole milk or milk replacer after that first colostrum feed. And we're now seeing gains to be made by feeding colostrum in an extended fashion, because colostrum is not just immunoglobulin molecules. It contains a lot of other immune modulators and immune cells like cytokines, neutrophils, macrophages, leukocytes, vitamins and minerals, all sorts of other goodies in there that have a real effect on the calf morbidity and mortality, average daily gains and productivity. So we're not really clear at the moment on what extended colostrum feeding means per se. It can mean a number of different things. It can either mean feeding whole milk or milk replacer with a powdered colostrum replacer or supplement added, or it can mean adding a small amount of first milk in colostrum to the whole milk or milk replacer, or it can mean feeding transition milk, which is second and third milking secretions from the cow's udder after she's calved, in an extended way. But what we do know is that a small amount of colostrum supplemented for a more extended period is more beneficial than more of it supplemented over a shorter period in terms of the health gains to be made. So we're currently trialing a sort of extended transition milk feeding program versus a more sort of traditional switch them straight onto milk replacer. And we're seeing some pretty promising results from that work. So I guess it's watch the space and hopefully be able to share some results from that study in the near future.
Thank you, Katie. I think we've had a really good comprehensive overview of projects around calf health and colostrum. Just by way of just wrapping up, do we have any concluding thoughts or take-home messages from both of you?
Will I jump in first,
Annie?
Katie?
Yes. Thank you.
I guess cleanliness can be overlooked, and whilst visual inspection you can see, oh, I think it looks pretty clean. Obviously if there's a lump of cow dung or straw in there, it's obviously grossly contaminated, but even when they sort of visually look clean, they can be quite dirty, and the knock-on impacts of dirty colostrum can be massive. As Katie alluded to, we have this window of opportunity in the first 24 hours to impact the calves' long-term life, health and production, and we can take really simple steps to try and mitigate that. So from a farmer's point of view, we need to consider colostrum cleanliness, but also from a kind of vet's point of view, when we are investigating calf health issues, not only paying attention to the antibody content of this colostrum, but also taking steps to have a little investigate on farm about how clean the colostrum has been delivered to the calves.
Katie?
Yeah, and I think from me, I say this all the time when I talk about herd health principles with my undergraduate students, but it's an important reminder that each farm is a sort of unique system, and there isn't going to be a one-size-fits-all approach to solving calf health problems. Important to remember, if you're monitoring serum IgG concentrations in calves, or indeed testing colostrum quality, that you need to take a reasonably large number of samples to have a representative idea of what's actually going on the farm. And you probably need to do that a number of times to monitor the situation, rather than just getting a sort of prevalence snapshot of what's actually happening. Do it repeatedly and take large enough numbers so that you can talk confidently about what you're actually seeing. And then keep abreast of some of the exciting changes that are happening in terms of calf health management. You know, I've mentioned the extended colostrum feeding piece. I think it's a really exciting area of research that's coming to the forefront. We've talked a lot about IgG in the past, but there's a lot of other things in colostrum that we don't fully understand just yet. And they have hugely beneficial effects on calf health. So definitely an emerging area of science. And don't forget the bacteria as well. That's a really practical step on farm that you can do. You know, just clean up your act, get your farmers to clean up their acts, and the calf health should follow suit.
That's great. Thank you for those top tips. And thank you, both of you. We hope that our listeners have found this podcast useful. And this podcast follows a webinar on the same subject, and I'll put a link to the webinar in our podcast notes. So thank you to Katie, and thank you to Ali. Really pleased that you could join us today.
Thanks for your time, Alison, too.
Yeah, thank you.